67 things you have to make sure you've got right. If you've got those right, you're pretty confident you can take this to sale and have a pretty good process.
If there's one piece missing, it could make the project non-viable. I mean, if you can't get a cable from one bit to another bit because of a third party in between and he doesn't want to deal with you, if you can't get around it, you can't get around it. When we were doing wind, there was 67 points of gap analysis that you knew if you covered off every one of those points, you knew you had a completely robust project. Batteries are around about the same sort of number.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Transmission. In today's episode, guest host Ed Porter is joined by Mark Wilson, CEO of ILI Group. They discuss what the developer is involved in beyond just building a storage asset. If there's a topic that you'd like to hear discussed on Transmission, please let us know in the comments. We'd love to hear from you. And don't forget to hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. With that, let's jump in.
Welcome to Transmission, and on this week's episode, we have Mark Wilson joining us from ILI, and today we're going to be covering the world of developing battery storage projects. Mark, welcome to Transmission.
Thank you very much. I say thank you very much for having me here today. It's a pleasure.
And actually, just to get straight into it, so one project that you have developed and transacted on at the end of last year was a project called Red John. Would you be able to give us a little bit more detail around what exactly Red John is?
Yes. So Red John is a pumped storage hydro project. It's 450 megawatts and it will now have a duration time of 9.5 hours. For anyone that doesn't know what pumped storage is, it's a very simple technology, well proven technology. I think 95% of the world's energy storage is pumped storage hydro. You basically have a reservoir at the bottom of a mountain and you have a reservoir at the top of the mountain. You have tunnels under the mountain with a cavern, which will have turbines, and they basically join top reservoir to bottom reservoir. When there's excess energy on the grid, which we see a lot of now, certainly in Scotland with offshore wind, rather than switching those turbines off and wasting energy, but also having to pay the developers to do it, so wasting money, you'll use that energy to pump the water from the lower reservoir to the upper reservoir. It'll be stored there, and then when there's no wind or no sun, rather than putting on gas plants, you're able to hit a button, the water goes down the tunnels through with gravity at force, goes through the turbines, creates electricity. And this can be repeated time and time again. So Red John from conception took 8 years, and we just recently sold it to one of the main top renewable companies globally, Statkraft, who we believe are probably one of the best companies in the world to take it forward and build it out and be able to operate it efficiently and effectively.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And in terms of where Red John is right now, so you've sold the project to Statkraft. What do they get for that? How far along is Red John as a project?
Right. So what we've been going, or Intelligent Land Investment has been going for 21 years. We've been doing different sectors, and now we're fully focused on energy storage. What we do as a company, which would be seen as our unique selling point, is packaging up projects. So for any type of project, we focus on Red John. You need to get all the land consents. You need all the access. You need everything. If you're looking at the footprint of that project, you need to be able to manage and control all aspects of that. And there could be hundreds of pieces in that jigsaw. You then need to get the planning. And for a project of that size, that goes to the Scottish Government through the Energy Consents Unit. Again, the documents for that are thousands and thousands of pages, which will take in every aspect of that project, obviously ecology, biometric surveys, ground conditions, you name it, it's in there. You deal a lot with the local communities. You obviously need to get everybody on side to make sure so they understand what you're doing and see the positives of it. That there is going to be obviously an element of during the construction. There's an element of, it's not going to be super positive for the local people, but over that term, they can see the benefits. And we were able to certainly get that message across to everyone. And then you've also got the grid, which is, if you don't have a grid connection, you don't have a project, as you well know. So we were able to secure a grid connection early, and we've got a grid connection there for 2027. Looking at the press and speaking to Stackhouse, certainly looks like that project will be, if not the first, one of the first pump storage projects operational in the UK in about 30 years. So there's literally hundreds of pieces to the jigsaw to bring the whole project together. But we've got Statkraft have now got at a point where they can design it to how they want it to be designed, and then look to take the financial close, get all the contracts for the construction people, and start building it.
Okay. And in terms of then Red John going on and into operation, so right now there kind of aren't shovels on site. No one's moving any turf. There is kind of still a few major things to happen. So as you say, Statkraft now needs to go and design the site, and then they need to appoint an EPC who would then go and build the project itself, then go through final testing before that would then be allowed to charge and discharge to the grid.
Yes, but as far as I know, there is a lot going on at the moment. There's, as far as I know, drilling's going to commence relatively shortly. So no, there's a lot going on with the project as we speak. It's really happening.
Okay, great. And just to kind of understand a little bit about the strategy that ILI have here, right? So it's taken you 8 to 9 years to build this project. You must be super close to it. You must be, you know, it's kind of a project that you've worked on for a very long time. Why do you step away from that project? Why do you sell it to someone else?
To be completely honest, because we know what our abilities are. We, as I say, we've been doing all the pre-development work for projects for the last 21 years, which a lot of people don't actually like to do because it's high risk. And we've become, we believe, very good at that. And what we believe is getting a site ready to build. And I see it as, and we'll be doing it for our next pump storage projects as well, we're not developers and operators for a project of that kind of type of animal of that size. And to us, to see the best chance of success is to pass the baton to the experts and let them go and do the next part of the journey and make it happen. So it's been realistic, but ensuring that these projects come to fruition.
Mm. And so you say that almost like in that lifetime of from the first instance that project is imagined through to going live, you need a specialist at pretty much every single stage. And so you kind of hold that specialism for the first part, and then you pass that on to whoever it may be. In this case, Statkraft, who kind of brings it through. And just to kind of, one thing you mentioned there was around the kind of high risk of these projects. And it would be great for listeners to understand, because from the outside, perhaps it sometimes seems like every project that you look at, you develop through to completion. So do you have an idea of kind of the number of projects that you have to look at in order to get one through to that kind of ready to build stage? And we'll come back onto ready to build in a second.
Well, I can just say what we did. So when we embarked on looking at energy storage back in 2015, we felt the pump storage was the best technology to go with, but also for long duration storage. And we're also doing a lot of lithium battery for short duration storage, which I'm sure we'll come on to. We looked at over 130 locations in Scotland for the pump storage, and we whittled those down with the help of ACOM to 3 projects and basically scored them. And we believe they're the best sites in the country. There are other sites you can take forward, and there's a bit of a myth that there's not a lot of sites out there. There are, but certainly we feel we've got a really good head start, and we've got the 3 best that we're taking forward. But yeah, it was 2 years of hunting.
2 years to find 3 from 130. And I think people will want to know, what do you pick for? Like, are you looking for kind of the tallest mountain, the easiest to develop site, the best transport links, grid connection? Like, what's the secret sauce of finding those 3 sites?
You've kind of just nailed it there. Grid's absolutely important. So you don't want to be too far away from a major substation, a 275 or 400 kV substation. You want to ideally have a lower head pond, a lower lock, or an upper head pond or an upper lock. If you're lucky enough to find both with a one and then the one up in the mountain, well, then obviously your costs are going to be, your CapEx is going to be a lot less. For all our projects, we have got a lower head pond. So for Red John, we're using, or lower pond, we're using Loch Ness. Our other ones, or Ballymeanet, which is the next one that's most advanced, is using Loch Awe. That'll save significant funds for not having to build an upper reservoir and a lower reservoir. So that's just looking to try and make your CapEx as efficient as possible. Obviously, you need good access. You don't want to go into triple SIs or anything like that. You want to be, you've got to take, the most thing is you're looking at the ecology of the area. There's going to be areas that you just do not want to go into because you're going to have an impact. And that's where we got AECOM on board. We brought in the experts to score each of our sites. So we were doing as little impact as possible.
Yeah. Could I ask about a triple SI? What's a triple SI?
So a triple SI would be like a nature reserve, or it's like an area that just you just don't build on. You just don't really touch. There would be, I'm trying to get, the Peak District in England would be a triple SI, things like that.
Okay.
Places like that.
And in terms of ILI, it seems like most of your investment is focused in Scotland. What's the reasoning behind being mostly based in Scotland?
Well, it's because we live here. As you can probably tell, I'm originally from Ireland. I grew up on a farm and my dad bought a farm in Scotland. So that's how I come to be here. But when we started off 21 years ago, we started off looking for strategic sites for residential. And then we moved into onshore wind when the feed-in tariff came out. When we were doing the wind, we signed up over 600 farmers in the country. So we've now, with the energy storage, we've got about 800 farmers on our books. So what we've found is a bit of an advantage in staying in our local area, our local country, is everybody knows us and we've got a very good reputation. So if the landowner doesn't know us, his neighbour's likely to know us, or his neighbour's likely to know us. So that goes a really long way for us to be able to get these projects through quickly and effectively. We could move into other countries, and we have thought about it.
Okay, interesting. And from an energy perspective for Modo, we definitely see Scotland as being a really interesting location, largely because you have lots of offshore wind connecting in Scotland that struggles to essentially be able to shift energy from Scotland to England because there are only certain sizes of cable. And so you do get these times where you've got too much generation in Scotland. And so there's a good business case for batteries that want to charge from that excess generation. So for a pumped storage project, and particularly anything longer duration, there's a kind of a really clear reason that Scotland is a good location. Let's move on to batteries. If we could just take a second to sort of talk through, like, what exactly makes a site ready to build?
So if you're looking at just a standard 50 megawatt battery site, we would, it sounds easy when we say it, but it's because we've been doing it for so long, but we would go out, sign up the landowner next to a substation that we know has got capacity. We know which substations in the country have capacity because of our experience with onshore wind. We'll get all the land rights signed up. If that cable isn't next to the substation, that has to go through other landowners, we'll get third party rights to go lay the cable underground to get from A to B. We'll be doing the planning in parallel to that, and we'll also have done the grid application in parallel to that as well. We started putting grid applications in 2016, 2017. So we've been very lucky to, because we could see this coming, that we have early connection dates for most of our sites. I mean, we've already sold 850 megawatt sites into the market, and they were all sort of 23, 24, 25 connection dates. We've got, I think, 2.1 gigawatts of sites at the moment, all 50s, 100s or 200s, and most of them would be end of 25, 26, 27, maybe one or two, 28. So these are the sort of sites that the market needs to get us to our target. Although things are changing, the grid, the whole grid system's changing as we speak. So hopefully that allows more to come on.
Yeah. And maybe more on that in a second. But just when you then take a battery site and you then sell that on to the next owner, and that could be someone like a Statkraft, people in the market talk about a developer premium. So would it be possible just to kind of talk through what is a premium, and perhaps why is it bigger for some sites and smaller for others?
So packaging up the sites and getting them ready to build is, as I say, sounds easy, but it's not as easy as it sounds. I know, talking to a lot of developers, there's a lot of sites out there that when they go through and do their due diligence, there's missing pieces. A nice way I like to describe what we do is, when we give you a site, when we sell you a site, when we go to legals, you'll bring in your legal team, we'll bring in our legal team. We know we're gonna close that deal, because when we did the win, we signed up 600 landowners and we got 140 sites into planning and we got 96 consents. And most of my team have been with me for 15 years. So you imagine doing the same thing day in, day out for 15 years. It's like playing a piano or a violin or whatever. You're going to be bloody good at it after that period of time. So the team we have is just phenomenal. They know what they're doing, standing on their heads. But to package those sites up and to know that they're going to complete, the client or the developers that we have dealt with, who we speak to all the time, I know would do repeat business with us because it's a premium product. There's not going to be holes. There's not going to be pieces missing. And that's the most important thing is when you get that jigsaw box from us with the lovely picture of the battery site on it, you know, when you open it up, every single piece will be in that jigsaw. And that's our USP.
Okay. And that developer premium, right? So you're saying, almost implied within this, is that some of those sites out there, and there are a lot of sites out in kind of the GB market at the moment, you're saying that some of those might be missing one of those parts. So it might be missing, or it might have a really long connection to a substation, or it might not have one of the kind of required pieces. And then that would mean that the developer premium is significantly less for those projects.
I can't say for sure, because I say I can only listen to third parties, but that's certainly a possibility. If there's one piece missing, it could make the project non-viable. I mean, if you can't get a cable from one bit to another bit because of a third party in between and he doesn't want to deal with you, then if it's a 33 kV project, then if you can't get around it, you can't get around it. There's no, potentially no project. And there's lots of elements like that within other aspects of the project. So it's, when we were doing, when there was 67 points of gap analysis, that you knew if you covered off every one of those points, you knew you had a completely robust project. Batteries are around about the same sort of number.
Mm-hmm. So you got to see sort of 67 things you have to make sure you've got right. If you've got those right, you're pretty confident you can take this to sale and have a pretty good process. And maybe just talking then a little bit about how this has changed. So you've obviously been in the market since 2015 and ILI for 21 years. Developer premiums have been up and down. Maybe you could kind of give a bit of a story in terms of how that's changed over the years.
Yeah, so we had sites ready, fully ready to develop in 2018. The COVID hit and we had offers, and then those offers understandably disappeared. The market, we seen the market come back in 2000, really start in 2020. It took a long time for funds and developers to get comfortable with the revenue streams. And then it really sort of, in 2021, people just got comfortable. It just really sort of gained traction, as I'm sure you know. And prices went up, started off at around about 20,000 a megawatt and jumped to, at one point, well in excess of 130,000 a megawatt. So huge growth. And we're interested to see now where the market's going to be at. We're still listening to a lot of the developers we know and the guys that are in for the long term. It's the story's not changed. Mm-hmm. Revenues have been uncharacteristically low this last year. But most people see that as an anomaly. That's not going to be a normal occurrence. It's going to go back the way it should. The way we expect. It's just common sense. The more renewables that you bring onto the system, the more gas we get off as soon as possible, the more volatility there's going to be on the system, and the more that batteries and other forms of storage are going to be required. And you'll obviously get paid for that. So if you've got a long-term view, which is the only way to look at this, because we're all trying to get to net zero, it's busy.
Agreed. And I think we've certainly been saying that exact picture for a long time. You know, this particular year that we're in right now, if we take a forward-looking view, solar will grow from here, wind will grow from here, and we currently have a lot of legacy gas that's online. Those three things will all change in directions that will support storage, both short-term and long-term. So we definitely see that same positive picture. If we were to turn this into a bit more sort of reality of the here and now, I know right now you're working on a battery project called DICE, I think, and that's a 50 meg project. You're currently taking that to market. What does the process look like from there? And one thing that's kind of, I think, really interesting for me is, well, how many people are going to kind of knock on your door and say, oh, you know what, I want to be part of owning that project?
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've only had it out since Monday. So at the moment we have all notes of interest have to be in by the 31st of January. And at the moment we have 9. Normally at this stage, we probably would have more. We would put out to our database of all the people that have contacted us in the last 4 or 5 years, and it would be about 50 companies, roughly. I would anticipate, by the way the sort of flow, way things are flowing, I would anticipate about 15 notes of interest by the 31st, and then we'll look for non-binding offers by the 16th of February. Now, last year we were getting up to 12 non-binding offers, which I've been in other markets like the housing market and the onshore wind market, and I've never seen anything like that. I do think that will level off a little bit, because there will be companies that have tried to jump in maybe too quickly and haven't been properly funded, and maybe just thought there was a quick buck to make. I don't think believe in any such things. Everything takes time. But the guys that are in long term will expect offers from all those guys. So I'd be surprised if we don't get at least 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then of those 5 or 6, or maybe actually let's go back in time to a time when you had more people of kind of various quality bidding in for those services. Would you always, like, would you say, oh, absolutely, we'll accept the highest price? Or would you kind of look for people who you're really confident can take that project through to completion?
Absolutely the latter. We're looking at ability to bring the project to fruition. We've had scenarios where, and it was mainly in the past with wind where we learned that lesson, is price is one element of it, but it's more the element of can you deliver? Do you have the experience in dealing in this sector? So having previous projects on the ground is a big plus, and just the ability to make it happen. Price certainly does come into it, but it's not the number one point. Anyone can make you a big offer.
Yeah, exactly. So I wanted to run through three more things before getting on to final questions. So the connection queue. This is something that people in the energy space will have heard a lot, and there's been a huge amount of discussion around connection reform. What's the impact of the connection reform going on in the UK on ILI?
Well, we've been very fortunate. We got in early, so most of our sites have pretty early connection dates that are attractive to developers and funders. We have some sites that we are talking to SSE and Scottish Power, who are our main DNOs, to bring in earlier connection dates, which would be a bonus. We see it as a very good thing. I mean, there's a lot of sites out there that are potentially holding back really good projects. And I'm not talking about us, I'm talking about other people in the market. And those projects should be going ahead. We don't feel as if we're competing with anyone. We're doing what we're doing. We're delivering, hopefully, at least 4.5 gig of energy storage and different technologies, and we're looking at other technologies now and taking those forward, and everybody's got to play their bit to get there. So the whole system, the rules being changed, is a very positive thing we see.
Okay. And just to put some numbers, so you mentioned there that some projects have been brought forward. That could be a year, could be 5 years. I think we've heard a number of like mid-2030s potentially coming into being late 20s projects. Is that something that you've seen when you've been offered these sort of advanced or earlier connection dates?
That makes sense. If you're looking at just the logistics of a project, I mean, if you have those sort of dates bringing them into late 2028, 27, 29, that makes sense. But I don't see, it's like if somebody's got a 2030 that it's going to get brought down to 2026 or something like that, because I mean, even to order equipment, some of the transformers and the like, takes a couple of years to get those in. So you're talking 2 years just for the equipment. And then each D&O is absolutely full on at the moment. So they've got a schedule that they can only work to, or so many, they've only got so many spaces within it. So it's looking at what's realistic as well. So I think sites will get brought forward, and more importantly, a lot of the zombie sites will be get taken out. But I say it's a good thing. It'll be interesting to see how it all unfolds.
I have to ask, what's a zombie project?
So a zombie project is, well, I just call it, it's a dead site. It's never going to happen. And maybe speculators have come in and maybe got a grid connection, but they're struggling to get the land rights. They're never going to get the land rights, or it's been refused planning. They're still trying to get planning. It's gone to the government. It's still being refused, but they still don't want to give it up. It's like at certain times with a lot of it, we drop a lot of sites because, well, at a certain point we say, well, we're just not doing the landowner any favors. We're not doing anyone any favors. Give it up. Stop kicking a dead horse. And that's essentially what we see as a zombie site. There'll be certain criteria like planning, grid, or not grid, planning and land rights that you'll need to have adhered to, I would imagine.
Hmm. And then with these projects, so I can imagine that you might have a project that 5 years ago looked like a 50 megawatt project, but actually, as you get closer and closer to delivery, you think, actually the fundamental technology is changing. Maybe onshore wind comes back, and there's a really good opportunity to kind of co-locate that wind, perhaps with storage, perhaps more likely solar with storage. That's much more what we're seeing. But just in this sort of theoretical example, wind and storage, if you wanted to change the tech that you have on your site, do you have to kind of reapply and go to the back of the queue, or can you kind of make adjustments as you're kind of working your way through to connection?
Again, rules are changing, and it might be different with each individual D&O, but my understanding is we had a project that we looked to, change the technology recently and keep the grid connection. And we were told that we weren't allowed to do that. So we just accepted that. Obviously we did our due diligence with our lawyers, but the reality is if that is the case, then that's how the new rules are set, and let's all play the game. That's how I see it.
Yeah. No, I think as long as it's consistent and fair, it makes sense. But as technology changes very quickly, you know, we might be missing opportunities to get more stuff on the grid sooner and kind of make more of the grid connections that we've got. So it feels like there might be a future change there. Okay, brilliant. And then moving on to the kind of the wider market here. So by 2050, we need this kind of number of 300 gigawatts of capacity live in the GB system. And the connection queue at the moment, the size of it is kind of talked about in various places. National Grid would talk about 500 gigawatts. So the number there that pops out is the 200 gigawatts of sites that kind of don't get built. So when you look at that number of 200 gigawatts, do you think, there probably are 200 gigawatts of sites that aren't really meeting the right levels that we should be building? Or do you think that there will be some good sites that will kind of not be built in order, or, you know, of the queue? Do you think we'll lose some good sites that perhaps if they had earlier connections, they would have been built?
Very likely, yeah. I think there'll be an element of funding that for some companies, that there's a lot of security payments that you have to make for grids to hold on to your grid. And that can run into several million pounds, depending on the size of the project. And that is maybe not an initial barrier to entry, but it then becomes a barrier to keep continuing. So I can see that being an issue for some people that are genuinely trying to have a good project. That's something that they need to go in quickly, try and resolve to make sure those projects stay successful. I do believe there's a lot of bad projects out there that are not going to happen either because people are just speculating and they don't have the funding, or they don't know what they're doing. The projects that have been picked are in the wrong locations. Like a wind farm can be in so many great locations that makes sense, but can be in some terrible locations that you just wouldn't even consider. Same for any solar, same for anything. I would say out of that, there'll be a very high percentage of projects that will potentially be thrown out, but that opens the door for then hopefully a rush of all the good projects, wind, solar, energy storage, to really sort of get traction and get built as quickly as possible. So I think it just gets rid of the wheat from the chaff. It just brings realism to the whole thing. And I found in the last 20 years, that's kind of how the world works.
Yeah. Yeah. Firm agreement from this side. In terms of then, last question on grid, if you kind of had a magic wand, or you're able to kind of steer grid's next change, we're trying to hit a net zero grid by 2035 or 2030, depending on kind of politics. But if you had that magic wand and you could kind of ask grid to do one thing next, what change would you make?
So I think they're doing it. I think if we can get all the sites that are never going to go ahead off the system, and it's like any queue, open it up for all the good sites that can very quickly be funded, be built and go ahead, you're going to see a huge amount of sites starting to be constructed and go operational. And a lot of good sites that are funded and in good locations coming on and getting earlier connection dates. I'm actually really happy to see what's happening is happening. You could maybe say it would be great to see that a few years ago, but it's happening now. So I think it's really positive.
Yeah. No, I think a lot of industry would actually share that view. So yeah, that's a really good sign. And one thing that's come out very recently in terms of other developments, so we've seen the release for consultation around long duration energy storage. And that's looking for non-lithium technologies to come and provide longer duration storage. You're perhaps in somewhat of a unique position in that you're both on the pumped hydro side, but also on the lithium side of this piece. So have you had a chance to kind of look through the consultation, and what's your take on it?
Yeah, so we've been ourselves and a lot of major big companies have been lobbying for this mechanism for 6 or 7 years now. At Westminster, and it's great to finally see it come to fruition. The reason it has to happen for long duration storage, like pumped storage and compressed air and technologies like that, is especially for pumped storage, is because the construction time is 5-6 years. These are massive capex. Red John's 600-700 million in capex to build it out, and as I say, the term will be about 5 years to build. If you don't have that floor, you're not going to be able to get the debt in to be able to build these projects out. The difference with batteries is we've been in the market. They can stand on their own 2 feet. They don't need it. They're making money. And see, the thing is, and this is the thing which I'm sure most of the battery guys will get, but they don't want the cap and floor. It's as simple as that. And any of them say they do, they need to dig deeper, because the cap and floor is exactly what it says, is it's a floor price and a cap. The cap will probably be somewhere, it'll be a single digit IRRs. Now, what I've watched the battery market over the last 3 or 4 years is the IRRs have been phenomenal, and you work on volatility. If I was in the battery market and I chose to go, you wouldn't choose to go cap and floor, because it would become boring, and you wouldn't make the sort of money that you should be making with that type of technology. Pump storage is a completely different animal that can last for 125 years. And the type of companies that take these forward are quite happy with a lower rate of return. So it's a moot point as far as I can see. The only reason I could see, and I'll be very blunt, is that maybe some battery guys that'll push for it is because they don't. It obviously competes in the marketplace with them. But if you're really being blunt as you can be, is I think that's really wrong, because we're all supposed to be trying to get to net zero. And it's okay, you make money, business is business, but the ultimate goal is to get to net zero. Everybody can play a part in this, and to push another technology out, I think, is just fundamentally wrong.
Yeah, yeah, I think that would be actually a view held by lots of battery heads. They would say 100%. We don't want to be pushing any technology out. I think where a lot of the industry would fall on this, they would say something along the lines of, let the market procure what they need. So if the market needs, say, 6-hour duration, we might not necessarily need, so we might be able to need that. We might be able to meet that at lowest cost through a lithium project. But if the market needs, say, 50 hours, then it's probably quite unlikely that lithium is going to be the best tech for that. And so I think the kind of people who have pushed back on this, it's mostly been around a kind of arbitrary exclusion. And they would say, well, actually, just just procure what you need grid. You identify the duration that you're after, and then you let the market compete, and then the market will come up with a good solution. And I don't think anyone is out there talking about 100-hour, 200-hour lithium system. That would just be well away from what is profitable.
Yeah, no, I'd say just analysis I've looked at over the last number of years, Jacob's brought out some good reports on it. And if you look at the cost per megawatt, and obviously the prices are changing, batteries have come down significantly over the years. It just, to me, it's two different things. Long duration, the same as it was for interconnectors, it's the same type of mechanism. Interconnectors weren't built until we got cap and floor, and it was for interconnectors. So you could kind of say, well, what about other technologies at that point? It's been brought out for a reason, because we need long duration storage. And let's get as much short duration storage out there as we can. Let's all fill that space. Absolutely, I'm all for that. But bring in the other technologies, the other long duration. There's obviously going to be a place for green hydrogen as well. And all these people, all these different technologies work together to get us to net zero. It's not rocket science. To me, it's easy. It's not difficult.
Yeah, I 100% agree with doing as much as we can, as fast as we can. One more kind of rebuttal on it just before we move on to kind of the final part. And that is on kind of some of the precedent that we've seen, right? So when we had the electricity market reform in 2012, 2013, we had CFDs that came in for renewable generation. And that was great. We needed that. They've been a huge success story. And we also, at the same time, there was a kind of concept of missing money, which is that if you subsidize one portion of the market with contracts for difference, which is good for renewables, then the other part of the market, which was kind of gas-fired generation that provides capacity, that then felt that it was missing out on revenues. And so the kind of concept of missing money was talked about a lot. And so they brought out both the contracts for difference for renewables, and at the same time, they brought out the capacity market. And it feels like this might be a similar thing, in that if you want to fund long-duration storage and exclude kind of short-duration storage from it, then you might end up with that same missing money thing. And perhaps one of the solutions might be, if you're going to fund longer duration storage, then you also might want to fund the short duration storage, because otherwise you'll get this kind of missing money thing going on. Is that something you'd buy into?
I mean, I can hear your logic with it. The big thing, as I said before, is when you dig into it, no, I just cannot see how any battery operator would even want to consider cap and floor. It's just not the mechanism for that technology. You're minimizing your opportunity to your investors or your fund, which is, you just wouldn't consider going down that road. So it's just, I say, that's just my opinion.
Yeah, perfect. Thanks, Mark. I have a whole, that has brought a new kind of angle to it. And I think you're absolutely right that if your cap and floor doesn't give you extra money, then there's no kind of, there is no missing money to it. And so it's just a different way of financing those projects. Brilliant. That takes us to the final two questions. And so the two questions are, is there anything you'd like to plug, and what's your contrarian view? And so if we go with the first one, so is there anything that you'd like to plug on the podcast today?
Not really. So we are very excited for the years ahead for the energy storage market. We have a strong portfolio. We're here to facilitate the market. We have what we believe a very premium product that anyone that takes it forward will get it built, and it'll be operational. So yeah, I would hope, if anyone doesn't know us, give us a shout and we'll see if we can help you out.
There we go, very good. And your contrarian view, something that you believe that the market doesn't.
Right. Well, I have this, my simple mind has this belief that because of the amount of resources that the UK has, the amount of offshore wind, the amount of solar down south, but certainly the amount of offshore around the whole country, a wind, is that we could become a global powerhouse. I see it's that if we could get so much more storage onto the system than we have set, we've set 60 gig, double it or triple it, and get our infrastructure sorted as quickly as possible, i.e. the grid, so that we can get the energy brought from up north down south effectively, but also be able to store huge amounts of energy and then use these interconnectors that we have going from the UK to Europe and become an exporter, but also be full the country has got full energy security. We don't rely on anyone, but we are able to then export huge amounts of electricity into Europe. That to me is, I mean, Great Britain maybe hasn't been that great, some people might say, for a while, but that would certainly make us a very, it would certainly bring back the great again. And I think it's very, very achievable. And would show the rest of the world how we could easily become the number one country in Great Britain, be the number one country for getting to net zero. I totally believe that. We just need to put the foot to the floor. The government is the government at the moment, but certainly the ESO and National Grid are, and all the DNOs are making changes to make it happen. So we just need to put the foot down and do it.
Yeah. Instead of the challenge of net zero, you're saying the opportunity of net zero, and think we could be the first ones there.
And much, much more. The UK should be able to hit net zero very easily with all the resources that we have, absolutely, and then do a lot more than that to facilitate other people.
Brilliant. Mark, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today. I love talking through just understanding exactly how someone gets a site from inception through to close, as well as all the pitfalls along the way, what all the terms mean, what a typical transaction looks like, as well as kind of views into the future and some hope for the energy markets in the UK as well, in terms of where we might sit within Europe, et cetera, become freestanding and do some huge exports to Europe. It's been a pleasure having you on. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Ed.